The first six pages are bits of the text which I thought was most relevant to what I'm going to say. The last page contains some sort of analysis. I suggest that you tear off the last page and keep it separate. So, let's see what time I'm beginning. Okay. Well, the topic of this paper will be narrower than the provisional title may have suggested. I do not intend to speak, except incidentally, about the metaphysics of forms, for example, or the ontology of the soul. My focus will be on a metaphysical schema that surfaces only towards the end of the Phaedo. The context is well known. Socrates, awaiting execution, has the task of convincing his interlocutors that the soul is immortal, and thus clarifying why, instead of fearing his imminent death, he looks forward to whatever rewards await him in the afterlife. The most astute of his interlocutors, Kebes, has expressed his concern that even a soul capable of surviving the body's dissolution might prove not to be altogether immortal, but could eventually wear out and die. Socrates' long reply, which runs from 95 to 107, is intended to shut off this danger by showing the soul to be inalienably immortal, the sort of thing that not only does not die, but in its very nature could not die. I shall concentrate on the final part of this reply, 102 to 107, which has come to be known as the last argument in Phaedo. Let me start with a minimalist sketch of the argument, prefacing a warning that the precise way in which I shall divide its work between two stages is unorthodox, but I shan't be arguing that point on this occasion. The outline is the top half of page 7, the one I recommended you tear off. So here is the outline as I understand it. Section A, a new metaphysical class, which I'm going to call essential bearers. Fire is essentially hot and imports heat to whatever it occupies. Analogously, snow is an essential bearer of cold, three of oddness, fever of sickness, and, importantly, soul of life. On the approach of the opposite property, cold, fire can either retreat or perish. What it cannot do is stay and emit coldness, i.e. become a cold fire. The same applies, with appropriate adjustments, to the other essential bearers, soul included. So that's the metaphysical class, these essential bearers. Now, there are two applications, according to the analysis I favour. Stage one, the soul's immortality. Since soul is essentially alive and imports life to whatever it occupies, on the approach of the opposite property, death, it cannot stay and admit death. Being thus incapable of becoming and thereafter being dead, soul is immortal. And that's the proof of immortality. Stage two, not about immortality, but about the soul's departure. Despite the close parallelism between the fire case and the soul case, there's one significant difference. Approached by the property it cannot admit, fire has the twin options of retreating and perishing. In the soul's case, however, the option of perishing is excluded, since for a soul to perish is the same thing as for it to admit death, precisely the property that it cannot admit. Therefore, on the approach of death, the soul is reduced to the remaining option, that of retreating, and it does so, we are to suppose, by leaving the body and going to Hades. Do we want to just pause to distribute? Are there any more copies of the handout? Oh, they've got them there. Sorry. What I've called stage two has usually been mistaken for the final step of stage one, construed as a sadly confused attempt to complete the proof of the soul's indestructibility. It seems clear to me, even though this is not the right time to argue the point, that stage one completes the proof of immortality, and that stage two defends a further distinct thesis that upon the approach of death, the soul must retreat from the body and go to Hades. Note that the soul's going to Hades when death comes has been central to Socrates' contentions from the start of the dialogue. So that stage two of the argument, as I've construed it here, is no trivial afterthought. The dialogue's very first argument for immortality, the so-called cyclical argument, 69 to 72, was likewise a defense of the Hades mythology. According to a certain religious tradition, Socrates there pointed out, the soul cycles between discarnate existence in Hades and incarnate existence here. His ensuing argument was at 69 to 72 was an attempt to vindicate this religious account of the soul's transformations by bringing it under a general scientific law. All change between opposites, it turned out, is correspondingly cyclical. And since making the Hades tradition scientifically respectable has been one of Socrates' leading aims all along, it should be no surprise that the last argument ends on a reaffirmation of Hades. Naturally, as in fact Socrates has earlier, hinted, the Hades motif may need to be deliteralized so as to exclude some of the traditional trappings of the afterlife. But what Hades continues to represent is the soul's successful detachment from the body, its continued discarnate existence, and in most cases its eventual return to incarnation at a level matching its acquired degree of purity or impurity. The conclusion that persuades Socrates to face death cheerfully is not simply that the soul is immortal, but that upon death it unshackles itself from its current body and embarks upon whatever progression it has earned. Hence, stage two of the argument, understood as a demonstration that upon the approach of death the soul retreats, is absolutely pivotal to the dialogue's conclusions, and it's no accident at all that this final stage of the argument concludes with the words, and so I think this will be at the end of the, presumably must be on page six of the handout, I forgot to note it, concludes with the word, it's no accident at all, so it concludes, and so he said, more than surely than anything, Cebes, soul is something immortal and imperishable, and our souls really will exist in Hades, so that's 106e, 4 to 6, right at the end. That ending not only captures Socrates' intended emphasis, but also directly leads into his concluding myth, in which he conjectures what the real nature of Hades must be like. A further vital point is one I've already indirectly broached. The last argument, just like the cyclical argument, is an attempt to make a religious tradition scientifically respectable. The cyclical argument did this by showing that the cyclical transformations of the soul were no exception to a general scientific law of change, equally applicable to moral, mathematical, and biological processes. Similarly, the last argument aims to show that the basic laws it's applying to the soul, particularly the ones about retreating or perishing, are applicable right across the board, for example, to physical stuffs like fire and snow, to mathematical entities like numbers, to biological occurrences like sickness, and of especial importance to us on the present occasion, to imminent largeness. The reason for this strategy should be clear. If Socrates had limited himself to the analogy between fire and soul, as highlighted in the minimalist sketch that I offered on page 7, he would have faced the natural objection that fire and soul are two radically different ontological realms, or belong to two different ontological realms, the one physical, the other immaterial and noetic. And that's a distinction already emphasized by Socrates himself at 78 to 80 in the so-called affinity argument. In any case, the objection would run, no one need feel obliged to accept that fire and soul obey the same laws. Indeed, the fact that a soul is, by Socrates' own admission, ontologically unique, akin to forms rather than to sensible things, but not itself a form either, would suggest that no possible analogy between the soul and anything else could be probative. It's for this reason that Socrates' inductive argument seeks to cover as wide and heterogeneous a range of examples as possible. By doing so, he seeks to show that, like his earlier law of change, the current set of laws is topic neutral, not unlike the laws of logic. These laws, too, are of universal applicability and do not depend on the specific ontological status of the item under consideration. Hence, even something as ontologically sui generis as the soul must be assumed to conform to these laws. The wide variety of examples over which Socrates generalizes thus makes excellent strategic sense, but it's also what has generated most of the bewilderment experienced by interpreters. Socrates has previously, in his so-called Second Voyage passage, 99 to 102, has argued that the safest way to identify the cause of something's being, for example, beautiful, is to point to beauty as the cause. If instead we name, say, the thing's shape or colour as the cause of its being beautiful, we will never get fully consistent results. The same shape or colour will in numerous cases contribute just as effectively to something's being ugly. But if we stick to saying that it's beauty that makes things beautiful, largeness that makes them large, and so on, we cannot possibly go wrong. Such formal causes are therefore utterly safe, to use Socrates' term, but they're also, as he puts it, simple-minded, in that they do not in themselves tell us anything substantive about how things come to be beautiful. The fulcrum of the last argument is the proposal of a new set of items, what I've referred to as essential bearers, which combine the safeness of formal causes with the informativeness of the riskier kind of explanation exemplified by naming a thing's shape or colour as the cause of its being beautiful. Because of this informativeness, they're called more subtle instead of simple-minded. This is on page 5 of the handout, 105b5 to c7. That's the key passage. 105b5 to c7, the key passage where he introduces this notion of a more subtle kind of cause. If, for example, we say that the presence of fire in something makes it hot, that is genuinely informative about how the heat got into it, but still safe, in that fire, being itself essentially and inalienably hot, could never by its presence make something cold, in the way that the same shape or colour that contributes to one thing's being beautiful can contribute to another thing's being ugly. To say that fire makes things hot is thus safe in the same sense of safe, i.e. self-guaranteeing and immune to incoherence, in which it's also safe to say that heat makes things hot. Just as fire is an essential bearer of heat, so too snow is an essential bearer of cold, the number three an essential bearer of numerical oddness, and fever an essential bearer of sickness. Last and most important, soul is an essential bearer of life. A soul is itself essentially alive and makes whatever it occupies alive. Whether the presence of one of these items is a sufficient condition of its effects occurring, a necessary condition, or both, is not made specific. It seems clear, however, that all are, in fact, sufficient conditions, and that this is part of what it means to say that a certain item brings this or that property to whatever it occupies. Moreover, some of them, for example, snow as bearer of cold, three as bearer of oddness, cannot possibly be necessary conditions. Your feet can be cold without standing in snow, and the number of people in this room can be odd without being either three or, for that matter, 1,003. Nevertheless, it may well be a necessary condition that some appropriate bearer be present. For example, if not three, then another appropriately defined number. And it does become clear from the text that at any rate at the time of writing, Plato shared the widespread assumption that the presence of fire is a necessary condition of a thing's being hot. You can find that on page 5 at 105b8 following. But he says the same in the Timaeus, so it's a doctrine he was, like most Greek philosophers, was, it seems, committed to. And the presence of soul, likewise, is a necessary condition of something's being alive, as he makes clear at 105c8-10. What matters for the success of the argument, nevertheless, is that the item's presence should be a sufficient condition, provided only that the soul's presence in it is sufficient to make something alive. Soul is an essential bearer of life. At this stage, it's vital to insist also on the point that the essential bearers are particulars. Many scholars have supposed that at least some of the items in the class of essential bearers, perhaps even all of them, are transcendent forms. This, it seems to me, could not possibly be right. forms, as Socrates has emphasized earlier in the dialogue, especially at 78c to d, forms cannot perish. Whereas the main point of working through the examples of essential bearers is to illustrate systematically how these items have the alternative options of retreating and perishing. The essential bearers are precisely not separated forms, but a distinct range of immanent entities capable of occupying or withdrawing from individual things, and thus causing them to partake or cease to partake in essential properties that they themselves possess. The reason why comparatively few interpreters have followed this obvious line seems to be that one of the essential bearers, the number three, which by its presence brings oddness, is at one point specifically referred to as the form of three. This is at 104d, 5 to 6, page 4, 104d, 5 to 6, it's referred to as hair, tone, trione, idea, the form or idea of three. But elsewhere in the passage, Socrates makes it quite clear that he's talking about immanent tripleness, the specific tripleness of this or that trio of things, rather than the form of three, because the tripleness in question is repeatedly described as capable of perishing. The natural solution then, as some have seen, is to take idea here as meaning not a transcendent form, but a character in a metaphysically less restricted sense. The suggestion is borne out by the fact that idea has nowhere hitherto in the Phaedo, or in any dialogue likely to predate it, been used as a term for a transcendent form. Its use in that sense is in fact unexpectedly rare in Plato and might almost have gone unnoticed but for the famous pair of references to the idea to agathou, the form of the good, in the Republic. One reason why some have doubted that any essential bearers can be particulars has been that Plato is committed to the compresence of opposites in particulars. For any predicate F that has an opposite, G, whatever particular is F is also in some way G. If so, the number three, were it to be understood as a particular, namely immanent tripleness, would have to be even as well as odd. Fire would have to be cold as well as hot, and so on. And that would conflict with the assumptions underlying the argument, according to which an essential bearer cannot take on the opposite of the property it bears. In reply to this concern, it should be sufficient to observe that the compresence of opposites is a principle endorsed by Socrates in the last argument, but only for cases where the subject bears the relevant predicates contingently or relatively, in the way that Simmias bears both of the predicates large and small, despite not being essentially either one or the other. This is on page 1 of the handout. I won't read it out, but it's around about 102 C to D. That's the key passage on compresence of opposites. There was never any suggestion in the Phaedo or elsewhere that all properties of particulars, including their essential properties, are compresent with their own opposites or negations for that matter. And there's therefore no reason to be surprised that a particular case of tripleness should have oddness without the compresence of evenness, or a particular flame be hot and not also cold. I now return to the argument. The principles affecting all these essential bearers are fairly formally set out by Socrates along the following lines. Now we're on the second half of page 7, the standalone sheet. I'm going to use just an example on the right-hand side to illustrate it. This time I'm going to use snow instead of fire. In every case where some item X is the essential bearer of some property, F-ness, whose opposite is G-ness, the following principles obtain. One, X is not the same thing as F-ness. So, for example, snow is not the same thing as coldness. Two, X, so long as it exists, is F. Thus, for example, snow, so long as it exists, is cold. Three, X will never, while being X, admit genus. Snow will never, so long as it's snow, admit heat. Four, rather, upon the approach of genus, X will either retreat or perish. Thus, upon the approach of heat, snow will either retreat or stay and be melted. Five, X is not an opposite, but is permanently in possession of one, of an opposite, namely F-ness, in the way that snow has no opposite, but its essential property, coldness, is an opposite, the opposite of heat. CXX always imports its own character and Fmas to whatever it occupies, in the way that snow makes anything it occupies both snowy and cold. And 7, X is properly called G-less. It's actually done in Greek with the alpha privative at the beginning, but there's no good English translation. That is incapable of genus, in the way that snow should be called heatless, not meaning not hot, but incapable of being hot. Now, I've set out these principles on the handout more or less in the order in which they're listed, but actually principle 6 is initially announced as the one that defines the class. On the reference, if you want it, is page 4, it's 104c 11 to 12, where he tells us this is the defining principle. And we may take it that it already, for this reason, constitutes a sufficient condition of something's being an essential bearer. For on Plato's causal assumptions, the only way that some given item X could always import the same property, F-ness, to whatever it occupies, is by itself being essentially F. Given that, the other six principles follow easily enough from the defining principle 6. All of Socrates' examples can be fitted to the same analysis as snow, but with varying degrees of clarity. The vital principle about retreating or perishing, principle 4, is most readily intelligible for snow and fire. Snow, for example, must almost literally retreat, that is, be distanced from heat, if it's not going to perish, which is equivalent to melt. This provides the model that Plato needs for the eventual case of soul, which on the approach of death must spatially depart from the body and travel to Hades. Snow gets out of the way of the flame, the soul gets out of the way on the approach of death. A little strain begins to show, on the other hand, in cases where the retreating is not a literal spatial distancing. Consider fever. Fever is an essential bearer of sickness, and whatever body it occupies is itself made to be sick. What will it mean to say that on the advance of health, the opposite of sickness, the fever must either retreat or perish? Presumably, that it must either abate, the fever must either abate with the possibility of relapse, and that would be retreating, or that the fever must be altogether cured, i.e. it must perish. Retreating, this time, means something less obviously locomotive and more to do with becoming inactive. And some such deliteralization will be required, it seems, in all the other cases considered. Take oddness. Oddness belongs primarily to the numbers 3, 5, 7, and so on. It's thanks to the presence of one of these numbers in a set of things, for example, the set of chairs in this room, that set also becomes numerically odd. On the approach of evenness, if, for instance, I try to make the number of chairs even by subtracting one, the existing number cannot stay and become even, but must either retreat or perish. Meaning what this time? Perhaps if I remove a chair that I could later put back, the original odd number has retreated, whereas if I burn the chair, that number has perished. No doubt other interpretations could be devised, but I doubt if any can avoid taking retreat in such a case to mean something like become inactive. It should be emphasized at this point that the options of retreating and perishing were first introduced by Socrates at the start of the last argument. This is 102a following, near the beginning of the handout. It was introduced with a very different kind of example. And there too, retreat had to be understood along non-spatial lines. The case chosen was Simmias's own particular immanent largeness, the largeness said to be in him, in is the N in Greek. When he stands next to Socrates, who's smaller than him, his largeness advances. When he stands next to Phaedo, who's larger than him, it retreats again. What are we to make of this? It seems unlikely that what's called the largeness in us counts as an essential bearer at all. But unlike all the other essential bearers, it risks having to count as a simple-minded rather than a more subtle cause. What I mean is that to hear that Simmias's largeness is what makes him large may sound just as uninformative as it is to be told that beauty is what makes things beautiful. In order that it have a chance of counting as a more subtle cause, we'll have to assume that this imminent largeness is properly specified in terms of a precise height. What imports largeness to Simmias is not trivially his own largeness, nor for that matter is it his being, for example, 6 feet tall, which is just as good at making him small, for example, when he's placed alongside the basketball player. Rather, his own particular largeness is a combination of these two, namely, it's the precise capacity to exceed that being 6 feet tall confers. That Plato would define largeness as the capacity to exceed, I think, is supported by passages in a number of other dialogues. Correspondingly, his own imminent smallness is the precise capacity to be exceeded that being 6 feet tall confers. Even then, however, it seems unlikely that imminent largeness could count as an essential bearer. For according to Principle 5, an essential bearer is not itself an opposite, which imminent largeness clearly is. Also, according to Principle 6, if X is the essential bearer of F-ness, I quote, X always imports its own character and F-ness to whatever it occupies. Thus, I suggested, snow makes anything it occupies both snowy and cold. And likewise, we might add, fire makes things it occupies fiery as well as hot. Fever makes bodies feverish as well as sick. Threeness, or number three, makes things triple as well as odd. And finally, soul makes things ensouled as well as alive. Imminent largeness, by contrast, only makes things large, in the way that imminent tripleness makes things three, and there's no further property analogous to oddness that it brings with it. We should take it then that the last argument opened with the example of imminent largeness simply in order to introduce the concepts of retreating and perishing. What then are retreating and perishing in the case of imminent largeness? Presumably, for Simmias' particular largeness to perish would be for him actually to change height, or possibly to die. Its retreating will consist in his largeness, that is, his capacity to exceed, ceasing to be active, in that he is not currently being juxtaposed and compared with someone shorter. Clearly, in a case like this, retreat cannot be purely or even primarily a locomotive term. Yet the retreating that the soul will be shown to do on the approach of death could not, without serious damage to Socrates' overall contentions, be equated with its becoming inactive. It has to indicate the soul's departure to another place, outside its present body. The soul's retreating, in other words, has to be more closely analogous to the literally spatial retreating of snow or fire than to the non-spatial retreating of the number three, or of imminent largeness. What we're witnessing is not a confusion on Plato's part, I think, but a perhaps inevitable strain imposed by devising topic-neutral principles for application over a comprehensive explanatory range. Nevertheless, I think a common core of meaning can be discerned. All of the retreating items are being considered in their capacity as importing into that which they occupy, both themselves and, in the cases considered other than that of largeness, their essential property. And these notions themselves imply something like local presence. Maybe we cannot always give the precise spatial coordinates of your state of health, your tallness, the number of visible planets, or the fire that ancient physics typically presumes to make a piece of iron hot by being present in it. But that does not mean that they don't have spatial locations. Your state of health and your tallness are in you and are therefore wherever you are. Right now, for example, they're somewhere in this room. Likewise, the number of visible planets is in the solar system or the sky, and the fire probably has precisely the same spatial coordinates as the iron it occupies. If these items were said to retreat from their locations, the primary meaning would be that they temporarily ceased to import their essential property to the things in question. In some cases, the natural way for them to do that would be to depart spatially from the occupied entity, as the fire might be expected to do from the iron, and as, on at least a possible understanding of disease, your illness could be thought to do from you. In other cases, they might rather be presumed to stay but go out of use, as your tallness does when you're not actively overtopping somebody, and as the number of visible planets does when one of them goes below the horizon. In all cases, the common core meaning of retreat is that the essential bearer, while continuing to exist, ceases actively to occupy its host and to import its essential property to it. In the case of soul too, then, its retreat will consist in its continuing to exist, but ceasing actively to occupy and animate the body it has occupied up to now. In the context of Greek thought, especially given that death was earlier in the Phaedo itself defined as the soul's separation from the body, it was entirely natural to interpret the soul's retreat as its literal departure from the body. Was the theory of essential bearers just an ad hoc device for expediting the final proof of immortality in the Phaedo? Or was it an independent component of Plato's metaphysics? It must be admitted that it's quite hard to detect its use in other dialogues. A rare suspected instance occurs in the opening pages of the Parmenides. Parmenides there gets the young Socrates, usually and rightly taken to represent Plato's classical theory of forms, much as it's found in the Phaedo, to confirm that he thinks there is likeness itself, separate from what he refers to as the likeness that we have. Parmenides 130b. Here, the likeness that we have sounds like the immanent particular forms we've encountered in the Phaedo. Socrates goes on to give the same confirmation with regard to one, many, and the other predicates that were earlier mentioned in Zeno's reading of his own book. All of those have a form distinct from the equivalent in us. So what were these latter ones, the ones in Zeno's book? Zeno's book claimed to show that if there are many things, they're both like and unlike, both one and many, and so on for various other pairs of predicates. If we are to believe Proclus's report that there were 40 such arguments in Zeno's book, there were probably 40 different pairs of opposite predicates. More specifically, we have evidence that they included, as well as the pairs like, unlike, and one many, the further pairs moving and stationary, finite and infinite, and large and small. So Plato may appear to be acknowledging his own middle period acceptance, not just of immanent largeness and smallness, which we've encountered in the Phaedo, but also of immanent unity, immanent likeness, immanent motion, and immanent finitude, along, of course, with their opposites. Undoubtedly, Plato did assume the existence of such property instances or tropes right across the range of opposites. But he did not assign to them the full explanatory role that essential bearers are credited with in the Phaedo. Immanent likeness does not, as far as we can tell, import a further property along with itself, in the way that immanent tripleness imports oddness. So far, at least, their interesting metaphysical properties seem instead to be limited to just two of those listed for essential bearers in the Phaedo, that is, immunity to being characterized by their own opposite, so the likeness in us can never be unlike, immunity to being characterized by their own opposite, and a propensity to retreat or perish upon the advance of their opposite. Nevertheless, there is an aspect of the essential bearers that we have not yet considered, and it's one that this time they do seem to have in common with immanent largeness. I have in mind Plato's attempt in the course of the last argument to explicate a certain metaphysical distinction, one that we might variously try to map onto the distinction between the essential and the accidental, or that between the necessary and the contingent, or again between the absolute and the relative. This aspect is brought out in the discussion of immanent largeness. This is on pages 1 to 2 of the handout, starting at 102b8, which I shall read. However, he said, do you agree that the truth about Simmias exceeds Socrates is not as expressed in these words? Presumably, It isn't in Simeas's nature to exceed because of being Simeas, but rather because of the largeness that he happens to have. And do you agree that, again, he does not exceed Socrates because Socrates is Socrates, but because Socrates has smallness relative to his largeness? True. Right, and again, that he's not exceeded by Phaedo because Phaedo is Phaedo, but because Phaedo has largeness relative to Simeas' smallness. That's so. This contrast between what is in a thing's nature and what properties it happens to possess is a vital part of the metaphysics of essential bearers and encapsulates its contribution to causal theory. If you possess some property accidentally, contingently, or relatively, you do so because of something in you which possesses it essentially, necessarily, or absolutely. You are large only ambiguously and unstably, being large in relation to some comparanda, while small in relation to others. There's nothing about you that makes you necessarily large rather than small. Insofar as you're large, it's thanks to the presence in you of your own largeness. And it is this that, according to Plato, with the help of his usual self-predication assumption, is itself essentially and unambiguously large, and therefore is qualified to count as the cause of your being large. This principle does, it seems, carry over to the essential bearers as well. As a human being, you are contingently alive thanks to the temporary presence in you of something which is essentially alive, a soul. The number of banknotes in my wallet is by pure chance odd, thanks to the temporary presence in them of something, the number 3, which is necessarily odd. You are contingently and temporarily and relatively hot because of the presence in you of some fire, which is itself essentially, inalienably, and absolutely hot. In each case, the immanent item is primarily responsible for the predicate. It's only thanks to soul being essentially alive and fire being essentially hot that you too, derivatively, possess these predicates. The same pattern of explanation was in fact pointedly anticipated much earlier in the dialogue. This is right at the beginning of the handout. When the two interlocutors, Simeas and Cebes, were said, despite Socrates' reassurances, to remain a little bit afraid of death. Cebes expressed his fear more platonically when he said, "Try to convince us, Socrates," he said, as if we do have that fear. Or rather, not as if we have the fear. Maybe there's a child actually inside us who's afraid of things like that. That is, if you're afraid, but not irremediably so, we must not think of the primary possessor of that fear as you yourself. Since being eliminable, it is not part of your essential nature. Rather, the fear depends essentially on your inner child, a component of your psychology which might conjecturally be identified with perhaps your proneness to fear. What about the task of mastering this fearfulness? Since in the continuation of Socrates' metaphor, still on page 1, is represented as the task of lulling your inner child with an incantation, we can be confident that it need not amount to inner infanticide. If your inner child is lulled, your fear of death will retreat rather than perish, and a new doubt may at any time reactivate it. If then this model applies to fears, it's likely to apply to other psychological drives too, such as desires. Consider then Socrates' speech in the Symposium, according to which love is itself the proper subject of the verb to love, and also of its functional equivalent, the verb to desire. Given that A, love desires beauty, the argument then runs, and also that B, what a subject desires it necessarily lacks, it follows that love itself entirely lacks beauty, and is therefore not beautiful. This inference has been regarded with much suspicion. After all, common sense says that even people who are already themselves beautiful can perfectly well desire beautiful things. It's only, it seems to me, when we remember the Phaedo's distinction between essential and accidental possessors of a property that the inference begins to make sense. The contention in the Symposium is not that the people who possess love cannot be beautiful, but that love itself cannot be beautiful. And it's love, an inner state, that is here with some emphasis spotlighted as the proper or primary possessor of desire. Much as in the Phaedo, an inner child, fearfulness, was unmasked as the proper or primary possessor of fear. In the Symposium, love is an inner power or daimon whose very essence lies in the absence of beauty, along with the yearning to acquire it. And that is why love, unlike lovers no doubt, love must entirely lack beauty. I don't mean to claim that this now becomes an altogether unproblematic contention, just that we can't even begin to understand it without recalling the Phaedo's metaphysics, an attribute which some subject possesses no more than incompletely, transiently, relatively, or contingently, nevertheless owes its presence in them to something inside them that possesses the same attribute completely, permanently, absolutely, and necessarily. A provisional conclusion is that the full theory of essential bearers may well be found exclusively in the last argument of the Phaedo, but that at least some of its key components have a wider attestation in the corpus. The full theory describes how an attribute can come to be contingently present in a subject by riding piggyback on some further thing to which the attribute necessarily belongs. For example, a set of items may be contingently odd because their number three is itself necessarily odd and therefore imports oddness along with itself. The last argument puts its main emphasis on this necessity and its consequences. A reduced version of the theory omits the reference to a property riding piggyback on some item to which it necessarily belongs, but retains the central roles of necessity and contingency. By doing so, it helps explain why Plato's well-known thesis of the compresence of opposites need not entail a contradiction. If Simmias himself were the necessary, essential, and absolute possessor of the predicates large and small, he would be both large and small in every context and relation, which amounts to a contradiction. But fortunately, these predicates belong to him contingently and derivatively, only thanks to their necessary possession by two entities located in him, his own personal largeness and his own personal smallness. Those internal entities, being opposites, have to remain distinct from each other, and the metaphor according to which one of them advances while the other retreats is a gesture towards explaining how they can coexist as discrete items. Finally, we've seen the same metaphysical theory's less formal application to psychological subjecthood. Fearing and loving are attributable to human beings only contingently and derivatively, having as their primary subjects or agents those same human beings' correlated internal states or drives. Seabees will, by the end of the dialogue, still be Seabees, but will no longer fear death. So there's nothing about his being Seabees that helps account for his present fear of death. Nor will the part of him whose nature it is to fear such things, his inner child, have changed its nature by the end of the dialogue. Rather, thanks to Socrates' arguments, it will have been driven into retreat, while its opposite, confidence about death, will have advanced. Thanks to this metaphysical theory, we can glimpse in the Phaedo the makings of a Platonic psychology which, even without Republic IV's postulation of soul division, seems well equipped to account for the phenomenon of internal psychological conflict. One of the most prominent dramatic features of the Phaedo is the interlocutor's wavering between optimism and pessimism in the face of death. How such conflicts can occur within a unitary, rational soul is a puzzle which we may be better able to resolve if we give the motif of the inner child and the metaphysics that underlies it the full weight that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you.